We continue our study in the book of Ecclesiastes. So far, Solomon has presented four arguments that seems to prove that life is really not worth living. He talked about the monotony of life in chapter 1, verses 4 to 11. He talked about the vanity of wisdom in chapter 1, verses 12 to 18. He talked about the futility of wealth in chapter 2, verses 1 to 11. And then he talked about the certainty of death in chapter 2, verses 12 to 23. His argument appears to be true if you look at life under the sun. That is, from the human point of view. But when you bring God into the picture, everything changes. Life and death, wisdom and wealth, all are in God's hands. And he wants us to enjoy his blessing. And he desired to bless our heart, that we may in turn bless his heart. Beautiful relationship with God. If we rejoice in the gift, but forget the giver, then we are ungrateful idolaters. In the next eight chapters, Solomon will review each of these four arguments and will disprove them all. At the end of each argument, he will say, enjoy life and be thankful to God. So tonight, chapter 3 deals with the cycle of life and death. The chapter has two parts to it. The times and seasons of life in the first 15 verses, and then the mysteries and the certainty of death in verses 16 to 23. So first, the seasons and times of life. Solomon says, to everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to gain and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear, a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. What profit has the worker from that in which he labors? So Solomon argued that God has appointed a time for everything in verse 1. Even for wickedness, you will see in verses 16 and 17. Even for oppression, when we get to chapter 4. God has appointed a time for everything that we go through. All this is part of the eternal, irreversible, unconceivable providence of God that makes a person's labor profitless. Verse 9. Everything has a time, beginning period, and a season that's a fixed duration. For the first time, Solomon shifts from under the sun to under heaven. Everything is regulated and administered by a wise God who sees the end from the beginning. From where God is, our life, our world, everything is flat to him. He sees Adam and Eve over there, and he sees the people when they are born, when they die. He sees the end of Revelation and the Armageddon. It's one picture to God. There is a season for every work of God, and it comes in the season. There was a season for Israel, deliverance from Egypt. There was a season for them to go into captivity, and there was a season for them to return from captivity. In verses 2 to 8, the preacher itemizes 28 activities, 14 pairs of contrasts, ranging from external circumstances to the inner affection of a person's being. Some have suggested that the number 28 is the number of the world, which is 4, the world is number 4, multiplied by the number of completion, which is 7. The list is made up of opposites. 14 are positive, 14 are negative. In some ways, they seem to cancel each other out so that the net result is 0. So Solomon began with the concept of birth and death. He says there's a time to be born and a time to die. The life of men and animals. We have no control over this. We had no control when we woke up in a house of somebody, some strangers, some big monsters, and there will be a time for us to leave this world. We have no control over any of that. He said there's a time to plant, a time to harvest, a time to begin, a time to end the vegetable life. So it is the life of men, the life of animals, the vegetable life. Trees planted by one generation are cut down by the next generation. A time to kill, a time to heal. A time to take a life, a time to save a human life. We are not talking about murder here. That could include the execution of criminals or justifiable homicide in self-defense. You try to go rob Raymond's house, you may lose your life. There's a time to kill. He says there's a time to tear down and a time to rebuild, a time to construct, and a time to destroy buildings. Unsuitable, old, dangerous structures are removed and they are replaced by new and improved buildings. From the concept of death and destruction, Solomon then moved to the human responses to those events. He said there's a time to cry when someone dies, when a building is removed. There's a time to laugh when there's a new building, a new birth. There's a time to grieve. There's a time to dance. People experience weeping and mourning, and the opposite, laughing and dancing. Two activities by which joy is expressed, and flip-flop between tragedy and comedy. Then there's a time to scatter. A time to gather, the gathering and the rejecting of building materials. And this relates to the idea of building in verse 3. And the idea of the keeping and the throwing away in verse 6. Then Solomon spoke of the display of affection. He said there's a time to embrace and there's a time to refrain from embracing. There's a time to hug and a time to turn away. There's a time to gain, there's a time to lose, a time to search for something, and a time to give up the search and say, hey, let's lose it. A time to keep and a time to throw away. And this can also relate not only to the idea of the building, but in regards to affection. It could be a time to keep the souvenirs and the photographs of 1926, and a time to throw the whole thing away. There's a time for everything. Then the next one is a time to tear and a time to mend. a time to tear the clothes, whether, remember those people when they were grieving, they would rip their clothes. Or even in anger, they would rip their clothes. And then there is a time to mend those clothes, a time to make them serviceable again by repairing them. And then he says there's a time to be quiet and there's a time to speak. The appropriate use of the tongue, a time to sympathize with someone in silence and a time to express it out loud. Solomon closed his list of opposites by referring to life's two basic emotions. A time to love, a time to hate. Time to wage war, a time to pursue peace. The list closes somewhat as it began with a set of opposites, war and peace, over which again, people have little control. It started with something that we have no control over. It ends with something that we have no control over. Again, Solomon raised the question of the value of a person's work in verse 9. He said, "What lasting gain has the worker for all his labor? For every constructive activity, there is a destructive one. For every plus, there is a minus. The 14 positive works are canceled by the 14 negative one. So the mathematical formula of life is 14 minus 14, which equals zero. Man has nothing but a zero at the end of it all. He dies and he takes nothing with him. Job said in chapter 1, verse 21, naked he came, naked he returns. So we come here with nothing, no hair, no teeth. We leave sometimes no hair, no teeth, nothing. And you've never seen a hearse pulling a U-Haul or having a luggage rack. They don't take anything. In verses 10 to 15, we see three conclusions based on his observation. Conclusion number one is God's design is inexplicable. In verses 10 and 11, I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. God has made everything beautiful in its time. We used to sing that song. It was a beautiful worship song. There is an appropriate time for each activity. Men cannot comprehend it all. Maybe some parts we can. Nevertheless, God is working with the whole universe. He is working with mankind. And only in eternity will we discover and understand the divine design. Not before. When we are seated in heaven with God, then we will understand why all these things. And not all the why questions have no answer. God has put eternity in the hearts of men. People seem to have a longing desire to know the significance of their deeds or their activities. Solomon said that people cannot know the works of God from the beginning to the end. They cannot know the sovereign, eternal plan of God. We know so little. We see so little. God says there's billions of galaxies, billions of stars in each one, and he knows them all by name. We know very little. Conclusion number two, men should enjoy life as a gift of God. In verses 12 and 13, I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. Since man is ignorant of God's plan and cannot grasp the significance of all his labor, Solomon recommended that they should simply enjoy life. Don't try to understand everything that God is doing and why this baby was born blind, why this one was born deaf. Do not try to understand these things. This is the work of God. He stated that there is nothing better for men to do than to rejoice and be happy. They should make the best of life. Then conclusion number 3 in verses 14 and 15, men should fear God. I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing can be taken from it. God does it that men should fear before him that which is, has already been, and that, and what is to be has already been, and God's requires an account of what is past. So behind man's free will and choice stands the will of God. God's will is immutable. It is absolute. Man cannot alter God's design. Man cannot change God's plan. Solomon said the work of God is eternal and it is perfect. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing can be taken away from it. Then after his description of eternity in verse 15, Solomon said that God will require an account of what is past, what we have done. God is sovereign over history. So indeed, God should be feared. We will all stand before God one by one. Not as a group, not as a family, not as a church, one by one. Not even husband and wife. One by one. Indian file. No group. Not even two across. So God is to be feared, and there would be an accounting right here. So that's the first part. Verse 16, we start the second part, dealing with death, the mysteries of it, then the certainty of it. In verses 16 and 17, he says, I saw under the sun, in the place of judgment, wickedness was there. And in the place of righteousness, iniquity was there. I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. For there shall be a time there for every purpose and for every work. So we see two things here. We see injustice in this world now, verse 16. And then we see God's judgment in the future in verse 17. God shall judge. So there is a judgment. Solomon observed that injustice was popular where it should not be. He found crookedness in the courts where justice should be dispensed. He found dishonesty in governments where righteousness should be practiced. So he confirmed in verse 17 that God will judge both the righteous and the wicked, but the judgment will come in God's time. The time of this judgment is unclear. One thing is for sure, it is future, and it is in God's time. But the verse does not state nor imply that it will be in the afterlife. Solomon may have believed that the judgment could take place here on earth. It may take place in the afterlife, but not necessarily. God can do whatever he wants. There is a judgment coming in which God will vindicate his righteous ways. Time is short for the sinner's unrighteous work. Sooner or later, the judgment will come. Here, there, in the air, no matter, judgment will come. Then verse 18, he says, I said in my heart, concerning the estate of the sons of men, God test them, that they may see that they themselves are like beasts. For what happens to the sons of men also happens to beasts. One thing befalls them, as one dies, so dies the other. Surely they all have one breath. Man has no advantage over beast, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are from the dust. All return to dust. Who knows the spirit of the sons of men, which goes upward, and the spirit of the beast, which goes down to the earth? So I perceive that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him? So in the closing verses here of chapter 3, the preacher turned to the subject of death. He saw it as a depressing wet blanket that ends all of men's ambition, all his endeavors, all his pleasures. Everything ends. He viewed it exactly as we would if we did not have the Bible to enlighten us. He introduced his view with the words in verse 18, I said in my heart, it is not what God has revealed to him, but what he concluded in his own mind. It is his own reasoning under the sun. Therefore, this is not a passage from which we can build an adequate doctrine of death and life after death. Both people and animals come from the same dust of the earth. They are animated by the same breath of life, he says in verse 19. They go to the same place, he says. That is, they return to the dust, in verse 20. Solomon argued that man has no advantage over an animal, for both are short-lived, both are temporary. And that is not true. They do not all go to the same place. From the New Testament, we know that the spirit and the soul of the believer go to be with Christ at the time of death. Only his body goes to the grave. The spirit and the soul of the unbeliever, they go to a different place. They go to a place called Hades. That is a waiting tank, if you will. A waiting tank for the judgment. The animals, they simply perish. They have no spirit. So three different things happen. There is much debate over verse 21. Many teach that the spirit of man does not go up. It goes down and sleeps, waiting for the resurrection of the body. The soul of man was made for God. It returns to God when the breath of life ceases. Solomon closed the discussion in verse 22 with the only consoling thought he could offer. From what he knew about death, Solomon figured that the best thing that a man can do is to enjoy his daily activities. After all, this is his lot in life, and he might as well cooperate with destiny. Men should accept what cannot be changed. But above all, he should enjoy life as it comes to him, because no one can tell what will happen after he passes on. Man is to rejoice in his own works and not fret about the works of others or about the uncertainty of the future. We should not be concerned with that. Man's portion is to accept life from God's hand and to enjoy his work while he can. This is man's lot. Nobody knows what the future holds. But knowing God, knowing the God who is in control of life, that brings peace. Such knowledge separates man from beast. The beasts are never concerned about God. We are. So the main lesson of this chapter 3 is we live in a world of changes. The events of time and the condition of human life are continually passing and passing again. Yet every change is determined by the supreme power. We should therefore adjust ourselves to his purposes. The only true pleasure of life is in making good use of the things that God has given us, making ourselves helpful to those who are around us. Chapter 4 deals with discontent and impatience because of the oppressions and the iniquities of life. The chapter has four parts, bringing us to four different locations. The first part is in the courtroom, the first three verses. The second part is in the workplace, verses 4 to 8. The third part is in the household, verses 9 to 12. And the fourth part is in the palace, verses 13 to 16. So first, the courtroom. Solomon says, "Then I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun. And look, the tears of the oppressed. But they have no comforter. On the side of their oppressors, there was power. But they have no comforter. Therefore, I praise the dead who were already dead more than the living who are still alive. Yet better than both is he who has never existed, who has not seen the evil work that is under that is done under the sun." So sensitive hearts in every age have been grieved to see the oppression that is carried out by men against their fellow men. It is incredible what people are capable to do to another human being. And it tormented Solomon as well to see people being oppressed and they have no comforter. He was grieved to see three things in verse 1. To see the tears of the oppressed. To see the power of the oppressors. And to see the failure of anyone to defend those oppressed people. Power was on the side of the oppressor. No one dared to defy that power. From his point of view, it seemed that truth was forever on the scaffold and wrong was forever on the throne. He could not see that behind the dim unknown, God was standing in the shadow, keeping watch of what was happening. Solomon concluded that the dead are better than the living, in verse 2. To him, death provided an escape from all that persecution and all the cruelties of this life. He was not concerned at the moment with the deeper implication of death, that a person who dies in unbelief is doomed to more severe suffering than the worst oppression that they can have on this earth. For him, the question was not, is there life after death? For him, it was, is there life after birth? Solomon's cynicism reached rock bottom when he said that the dead are better off than the living, in verse 3. The unborn are more inviable, he says. They have never lived to be driven mad by oppressions under the sun. They have never had to endure the horrifying mockery of happiness, the thing called life. So that was his opinion here. Verse 4, we have that the second part, verses 4 to 8, deals with the workplace. disgusted with what he saw in the courtroom, the preacher went down to the marketplace to watch the various laborers at work. Surely he would not be disappointed there, but he was. He saw four different types of men in the workplace. Men number one, the diligent men. In verse 4, again, I saw that for all toil and every skillful work, a man is envied by his neighbor. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind. The man was not only hardworking, he was skillful in his work. He was competent in what he did. He had mastered the techniques of his trade. But what about his heart? It was a disappointment. He had a competitive heart, eager to stay ahead of the competition. And as a result, he was being envied by others. Man number two is in verse 5. The idle man, the fool, folds his hand and consumes his own flesh. The lazy fool with his hands folded, not working. The opposite of the first one. Not interested in labor. He is destroying himself. He makes no effort to provide for his daily needs. Totally non-competitive. And he will suffer the consequences for that. Man number three is in verse 6, the illogical man. He defends his lethargy with a clever proverb, better a handful of quietness than two hands full of labor. He argues that at least he has some kind of peaceful rest. He would rather have his ease and possess very little than acquire more thing associated with the aggravation of work. Better is a handful with quietness than both hands full together with toil and grasping for the wind. Then we have finally in verse 8, man number 4, the lonely rich man. There is one alone, without companion. He has neither son nor brother. Yet there is no end to all his labors, nor is his eye satisfied with riches. But he never asks, for whom do I toil and deprive myself of good? This also is vanity and a grave misfortune. So those who are wealthy crave more wealth. Wealth is supposed to be bringing happiness and supposed to make friends. But miserliness and greed separate a man from the others, makes him suspicious of everyone. They're after some of my stuff. They're after my money. And they're suspicious of everyone. And that drive him to live alone. The rich man already has more money than he will ever need. Yet he wears himself out day after day. He denies himself the simple amenities of life. It never occurs to him to ask the question, for whom am I laboring and depriving myself of good? He never asked that question. He should. Charles Bridges, in his exposition, said, I quote him, the miser, oh well, he deserved the name. The wretched slave of mammon, grown old as a toiling, scraping, griping worker. His name is miser, and as his name, so he is miserable. The first miser, miserable, get it? The same first five letters. What an empty, wretched way to live, thought Solomon. And I know people like this. They exist within the Christian community. In this section, we see two things. We see first the pressures on the successful in verses 4 to 6. Three types of pressure: rivalry, envied by his neighbor in verse 4. Apathy, lazy fool folding his hand in verse 5. And lethargy, trusting an illogical poem in verse 6. So we see the pressures on the successful, and then we see the loneliness of the wealthy in verses 7 and 8. Got plenty of money, but is alone at home, not even enjoying anything, won't go out to spend any of it. Verse 9, we have the third part. Now we move to the household. Solomon says, two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Again, if two lie together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. So in contrast with the futility of selfish greed, Solomon commended sharing with others by mentioning four advantages that comes from companionship. Four things come from companionship. Advantage number one, better profit, a good reward from their labor together in verse 9. They will get a good reward, not only a good paycheck in this life, but when they go and be with the Lord, they will get a good reward from the labor that they were able to do together serving the Lord. Better profit in this life, the life to come. Advantage number two, help in time of difficulty in verse 10. Advantage number three, comfort in time of need, verse 11. Body heat can keep another person from freezing. And advantage number four, protection in time of danger, verse 12. So 9, 10, 11, 12, you see four different advantages. So two are better than one when it comes to working, verse 9. When it comes to walking, in verse 10. When it comes to warm, in verse 11. And when it comes to warfare, in verse 12. Two are better than one when it comes to warfare, especially at night. The one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. It was dangerous for anyone to travel alone in those days, day or night. Most people traveled in groups for fellowship and, number one, for safety. When they traveled, they brought Jesus to the temple. They were traveling in groups. But I guess we could shoot holes in the argument about the keeping warm by mentioning the annoyance caused by a partner who has cold feet or who hugs the covers. Or the blessing of an electric blanket, right? But the point remains that there are lots of pleasures and benefits from friendship and companionship. He does not specifically talk about husband and wife. Companionship or friendship. Pleasures and benefits that are unknown to the one who lives alone in isolation. Having set forth the advantage of joint effort and the mutual benefits of sharing their labor and the fruit they're going to share with each other, Solomon lastly stated that if two are better than one, in verse 9, then three are even better than two, in verse 12. Solomon started with one in verse 8. Then he moved to two in verse 9. And he closed with three in verse 12. This is typical of Hebrew literature. One chord could be broken easily. Two cords required more strength, but three cords that are woven together could not be easily broken. So Solomon had more than numbers in mind here. He was also thinking of the unity involved in three cords woven together, a beautiful picture of friendship. But for us, what a beautiful picture of Christ being the third cord that binds two people together. And he said, when two or three gather together, I am there. He is the third one. We learn a great lesson in this section 9 to 12. We see the value of companionship. People often cheer the independent. They praise the self-made man, the self-reliant individual. Whatever deeds individual may accomplish on their own, it cannot compare to far greater achievement won by dedicated teams working together towards common goals. So the preacher placed a high value on companionship for four reasons. For productivity in verse 9, for assistance in verse 10, for comfort in verse 11, and for security in verse 12. Finally, verse 13, we have the last place, the palace. Better is a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more. For he comes out of prison to be king, although he was born poor in his kingdom. I saw all the living who walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stands in his place. There was no end of all the people over whom he was made king. Yet those who come afterward will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and grasping for the wind. The follies and vanities of life are not confined to the peons. They are even found in the palaces of kings. Solomon described here a king who overcame poverty, even overcame a prison record, in verse 14, in his rise to the throne. Yet now, when he was old, he was stubborn. He would not listen to his advisors anymore. Solomon said it would be better to have a poor young man who is teachable to reign in his place than to keep the old foolish king who won't be admonished anymore. Verse 13. The point of verse 13 is the insecurity of the king. His throne might be taken from him by the most unlikely challenger. Often men cling to leadership positions long after their effectiveness is gone. There's a time to start. There's a time to quit. It is very important to know when to quit. Their selfishness sometimes forces those who once loved and admired them to take drastic action to remove them from their office. In verse 14, Solomon noted that the population quickly rallied to the support of the youthful challenger. New king, let's vote for the new one. They were with the second youth who stood up in his place. The second youth is the youth who was spoken of in the preceding verses. He is called second because he was the successor of the old king. He was the man of the hour, verse 15. He was raised to high office while the old king is dethroned and humiliated. Multitude flocked around the new young king. The masses had a new favorite. They had a new king, verse 16. The popularity of the new king will not last. His influence was not permanent. A new generation will treat this king as the previous generation treated the old king. The implication is that the new administration did no more for the people than the old one had done. Surely the fickleness of citizenship and the perpetual failure of the leaders is vanity and grasping for the wind, Solomon says in verse 16. A man can become the leader of millions of people and be very popular, but then the younger generation will grow up around him and will reject him. The new crowd will depose that king and will appoint someone else. Oliver Cromwell, who took the British throne away from Charles I and established the Commonwealth, said to a friend, and I quote him, "Do not trust the cheering of those people who would shout as much if you and I were going to be hanged." That's the truth. Cromwell understood crowd psychology. That's how people are. Famous and loved one day, hated and despised the next day. Solomon understood that life is complex, it is difficult, and it's not easy to explain. However, he was not cynical about life. Nowhere does he tell us to get out of the race, retreat in some remote place in Oregon, in a corner of the world where nothing can bother us. Life does not stand still. Life comes at us full speed, without warning. We must stand up and take it, and with God's help, make the most of it. The main lesson of this one is the world is full of trouble. By reason of man's perversity, he is ever troubled and perplexed by social conditions around him. If Christ and the hope of heaven were not taken into account, to die as soon as possible would be preferable. But it is not. God has a plan for us, and he wants us to keep going. He wants to use us. Next week, we'll continue our journey with more from the preacher. So read chapters 5 and 6. The one thing that stands out for me tonight is very simple. Nobody can make it alone. The independent worker may get all the profits, but he is so busy making money that he has no time to enjoy it. And how rich will he be in the grave? There are risks in society as well as rewards. But the rewards are always greater than the risk. If you fall and break a leg, or if you are in danger, you will be thankful to have a friend by your side to help you. We all need times of solitude, but nobody can be totally independent. Life is tough enough even when we have friends around us to encourage us. It is still difficult. So do not be independent. Loneliness was the first thing that God called no good. Way back in Genesis chapter 2, he said, "It is not good for man to be alone." Loneliness is not good. Get friends. Get godly friends and value them. If you are married, your spouse should be your best friend. And with Jesus, the third cord surrounding the two of you, husband and wife, or friends together, nothing and no one will ever be able to break you. So may the Lord be with you. May the Lord bless each and every one of you. May he bless your evening, bless your work starting tomorrow, and may he bless your heart. May you continue to walk with the Lord And may you get godly friends to encourage you and to help you in this difficult life. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.